This is the To The Point podcast. Together with our ERISA attorney, we'll explore key Affordable Care Act and trending compliance topics, all in 15 minutes or less. Now here's our host, Sarah Gillespie.
Welcome to our To The Point podcast. This is Sarah Gillespie. I'm the compliance director at Lipscomb & Pitts. And today we are going to be talking about wellness plans. So I actually have two guests with me today. We have our ERISA attorney, Stacy Barrow, with Marathis Barrow, Weatherhead and Lind. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Sarah.
And we also have Betsy Kamler joining us. She is in our office here at Lipscomb & Pitts, and she is the director of wellness and employee communications. Hey, Betsy.
Hi, Sarah.
So I've got both of these two here so that we can kind of have a team approach in talking about wellness. And we know that wellness plans are a great way to help instill a culture of health and well-being at an employer's workplace. But bona fide wellness programs come with some compliance requirements. And so, Stacy, the first thing that we would like for you to explain for us is what would be the difference between a bona fide wellness program and perhaps something else that may be thought of as wellness, but not an actual program?
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned, there are various types of wellness programs, and they often run the gamut. You know, at the most basic level, you might have wellness programs that are like reimbursement of gym memberships, could be lunch and learns where people are attending health education seminars, or they could have a little bit more teeth, like the health contingent programs that, require an employee to perform or complete some activity that is either related to a health factor or that requires them to satisfy a particular health factor. So it might be a walking program or a diet or exercise program. And then you could also flesh those out more to require actual metrics to be met. Like you could have a program that says, well, we want people to walk for a half hour a day, or we want a walking program where you have to cover a mile and a half over that 30-minute time frame. And depending on how it's structured, different rules will apply. But I guess, you know, just at the most basic level, a wellness program, a bona fide wellness program, is one that is reasonably designed to promote health and prevent disease. And you know, as long as you're keeping that in mind, you have a fair amount of flexibility when designing the plan.
Okay. Thanks, Stacy. You mentioned health contingent programs. What is the difference between participation and health contingent programs?
Participation-based programs, they do not condition a reward on satisfying a standard related to a health factor. So in the examples I gave before, like reimbursement of the gym membership or, say, a program that pays for the cost of a smoking cessation program without regard as to whether the employees quit, that's participation-based. You're just participating. There's nothing that has to do with satisfying any type of a standard related to a health factor. And then once you get into the realm of the health contingent programs, they can be set up where, again, the activity just might involve a health factor, like a walking program or a diet program or an exercise program. Those are known as the activity-only wellness programs. And then you could have the outcome-based programs where you have to attain a specific outcome, like being a non-smoker, attaining certain results on a biometric screening program, like your cholesterol and blood pressure and BMI. All have to be within a certain range, and you know that's referred to as an outcome-based wellness program.
Okay, thanks. We have a lot of clients that just ask their employees to complete an HRA. So where would that fall in either participation or health contingent? Because it does ask medical and disability related questions.
The HRA itself, when it's there's no biometric testing, there's no further action required by the employees as a result of any issues identified by the HRA. That would just be participation based. There's nothing requiring them to meet any particular standard related to a health factor. So that typically is going to be participation based. But if there's follow up and they have to meet with health coaches and so on, then it is not just participation based anymore.
I suppose it might be helpful for us to clarify that when we say HRA, we mean health risk assessment versus the HRA, which would be the health reimbursement account. Those are two separate things. So the risk assessment is what Stacy is saying is participation only in most cases if there's no further action required. But we want to transition to what wellness programs look like and require today. So wellness programs have existed for many years and mostly under the guidance of HIPAA and ACA regulations. But a year ago, in May of 2016, the EEOC published final rules through the American Disabilities Act and GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, that have layered on top of HIPAA and ACA regulations. So, Stacy, can you help us go through a few of the changes, a few of the requirements that exist for wellness programs today that are hallmarks of a compliant wellness program?
Sure. And like you said, you know, for many years we operated under Department of Labor rules, which, you know, they have the enforcement authority over ERISA and HIPAA in this sense, not HIPAA privacy. These are HIPAA non-discrimination rules. HIPAA portability rules is where the wellness program regulations really fall under. But the EEOC under the ADA and GINA, as you mentioned, they have kind of a different mandate than the Department of Labor. And under the ADA, the EEOC really wants to make sure that any type of wellness program that involves a medical examination or a disability-related inquiry is voluntary. And that's just kind of one of the tenets of the ADA, is that your employer really cannot make you undergo any kind of medical exam or injury or medical exam or inquiry unless it's job-related. And so we have to always now evaluate the wellness programs under those rules. And as you said, they came out in the middle of 2016. They are effective for 1/1/17. And so one of the basic elements of it is that it must be voluntary. The wellness program must be voluntary. You cannot force or coerce or intimidate employees into participating. And so as part of that, in order to make sure it's voluntary, the threshold for rewards, or the limit for rewards, is in place. Basically, there's a 30% limit on rewards based on the total cost of single coverage, employee-only coverage. And so it's 30%, again, of that full total cost, like the COBRA cost without the 2% admin fee added back in. So there's a lot of room there to encourage change and healthier actions by employees. You know, if your single rate for coverage is $500, then the maximum reward is going to be $150 a month. So there's a lot of room there to effectuate some change. And if there is under the Department of Labor rules, you can go as high as 50% if the wellness program includes a smoking cessation component. But again, if there's testing, the hair follicle testing or the cotinine testing, then we're back under the 30% limit under the ADA, because now there's a medical exam or inquiry. 30% limit on the reward for employees. If spouses can also participate, GINA allows a 30% reward for the spouses. So again, a lot of room there to effectuate change, even under the ADA rules.
Okay. Thanks, Stacy. Also, there's the issue with the employee notice requirement. When should this notice be delivered if screenings are done prior to open enrollment, when other notices may be distributed for the plan year?
So that the notice you're referring to is a relatively new notice. It came out with the final regulations that were released last year, really going into effect for the first time this year. And the under the ADA, when you have an employer-sponsored wellness program that collects health information from employees, they have to be informed of four things: what information is going to be collected, how it's going to be used, who will receive it, and then what will be done to keep it confidential. And this information should be presented to employees prior to them completing the HRA. So if they're doing all of this prior to the start of the plan year, and they're giving out the open enrollment materials prior to the time the employee takes the HRA, then I think it works to include that kind of information in the open enrollment material. You should probably feature it prominently, but you can include it with other materials.
Okay. But it does sound like there definitely needs to be some kind of forethought into when it's delivered so that it's done before the HRA or any screenings take place.
Yes, and to the extent that the companies out there are working with vendors, most of the major vendors are very familiar with these rules. They may even have pop-ups on the website to capture or fulfill some of these requirements for employers. So it's always a good idea just to check with your vendor to see what, if any, elements is the vendor fulfilling. Because they might take care of those four elements right within their own privacy policy or member agreement or, some of their own communications.
So let's talk about how these new rules have affected spouse and children information, medical information. So I understand that a spouse's information can be given as part of an HRA if there's authorization, but dependent children information is not allowed at all. Is that correct?
Generally, you can incentivize spouses to provide their family medical history and information about the manifestation of a disease or disorder by the spouse. The rule does prohibit employers from offering incentives for employees' children, whether they're minors or adults or whether they're natural adopted children, to provide information to a wellness program. So typically, it's going to just be information about the manifestation of a disease or disorder in the spouse. And even then, part of the GINA requirements, as you suggest, the spouse must provide prior knowing, voluntary, and written authorization before taking the HRA. And the spouse also has to be informed that they can skip questions about the manifestation of a disease or disorder and still receive the full incentive. It really does water down the HRA quite a bit, because the spouse is basically allowed to kind of skip the medical portion of the HRA. Of course, the spouse is encouraged to complete it, and maybe they won't be able to get the same degree of follow-up if they're not putting in a lot of relevant information. But that's part of the tips for having a GINA compliant spousal HRA. We just want to make sure that you are letting them know that they don't have to answer those questions regarding the manifestation of a disease or disorder in order to get the reward, in order to be treated as completing the HRA, in other words.
Okay, thanks. And finally, reasonable accommodations. I know that's something that we always have to look out for. And can you speak a little bit to that for us?
Sure. There's kind of two terms that are somewhat similar There's the reasonable alternative standard, and those rules are found under HIPAA. And those are the rules that basically require the employer to offer an alternative if an employee can't meet one of the standards under the wellness program. For example, if your wellness program requires all employees to have a BMI under 30, then any employee whose BMI is over 30 would need to be provided with an alternative means for qualifying for that reward. I mean, maybe it's do a walking program, have some recommendations made by their physician. There's plenty of flexibility the employer has when developing those reasonable alternatives. And then separately under the ADA, there's also the concept of a reasonable accommodation. Under the ADA, it's a little more basic than the reasonable alternative standards required by HIPAA. The ADA reasonable accommodation, they just want to ensure that employees who have disabilities are able to participate in wellness programs. So, maybe the employer is hosting a smoking cessation class, and they have a deaf employee. Then they might have a sign language interpreter so that the person can, partake in that smoking cessation class. Maybe if an employee is blind, they would make materials accessible to them in Braille, or have some kind of an alternative. Like, again, if we have a walking program and there's an employee who's in a wheelchair, we obviously have to come up with some kind of reasonable accommodation, both under the ADA and HIPAA. We would have to give that employee another opportunity or another means of earning that reward.
Well, thanks, Stacy and Betsy. I think that this goes to show that there's definitely a lot of considerations to think about and prepare for in putting together a wellness program. And our office at Lipscomb and Pitts would love to help you look at a wellness program if that's something that you'd like to do or something you have in place and you'd like to have reviewed. We can always work with Stacy as well. If you have any questions, please contact me, Sarah G, S-A-R-A-H-G, at lpinsurance.com, and I can get those questions to the right place. Please listen to one of our other podcasts on other compliance topics. That's the end of our show. Thanks so much for joining us.